This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is out for the next couple of days. Well, it's coming. Sequestration. It's a strange word in this context. Why do we call this process sequestration anyway? Let's call it what it is. Budget cutting. $85 billion of government-inflicted across-the-board budget cuts, which will take effect at the end of this week, unless Congress can work out a deal on spending and taxes, which just about nobody expects will happen. Senator Elizabeth Warren was in Boston today talking about all of this to the New England Council, the Boston-based business group. Never one to mince words, Warren was blunt about what she thought of the looming cuts.
The sequester is just plain dumb. It is a blunt instrument to make across-the-board cuts instead of a thoughtful way to bring our financial house in order.
If they take effect, the budget cuts will hit Massachusetts in a variety of ways. The state could lose up to 60,000 jobs and $127 million in federal research funding. The NIH would have to slash hundreds of grants and stop or delay scientific research projects. Locally, the federal cuts would hit everything from aviation security to education to veteran services. Here's Governor Deval Patrick appearing yesterday with Louisiana Republican Governor Bobby Jindal on NBC's Meet the Press.
It is a fact that a sequester is going to have an impact, particularly on education in our state, and I think also in Louisiana. It's going to have an impact on innovation investments. It's going to have an impact on infrastructure investments. And those three things have been the formula for our growing in Massachusetts faster than the national growth rate and coming out of recession faster than most other states. It's a winning formula for the nation as well, and we cannot slow that down.
Joining us now to talk about where and how the budget axe is going to fall around the state is Scott Kirshner. He's the Boston Globe's innovation reporter. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Anthony. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. What's this going to mean for companies around Boston? What's your take on this?
Well, you know, this is anxiety that started surfacing last year when we all learned the word sequestration for the first time in this budget-cutting context. And you know, mostly where I was hearing it was from hospitals in Longwood Medical Area that have a lot of research staff and people who are trying to understand the nature of disease and how do you treat it, and also in what you might think of as the Kendall Square Life Sciences Cluster, places like MIT and Harvard and the Broad Institute. And, you know, everyone was worried, is worried even more so now that you know, the number of researchers they're having working on kind of this cutting edge of science would decrease. And I think as a result of that, you would see less of these innovative spin-off companies coming out of hospitals and academia.
So with these bunching, I mean, let's talk about the Innovation Center, for example, around Kendall Square. I mean, with less federal money flowing in there, what happens to that kind of research? Does it just stop? Is it shut down temporarily, or does it go elsewhere?
Well, you know, I think when you talk about an 8 or 10% cut, which is I think the number we're talking about in NIH research funding, it's like anyone would cut 8 or 10% at any company or in any you know, any endeavor. It's like you try to cut the stuff that seems like, oh, this is maybe too risky, or this is not going to pay off in the near term, or maybe it's kind of the junior researchers that are just kind of starting their career, and so they don't have the status to get their research preserved. And you just, I mean, I think what people worry about is you don't know what's in that 8 or 10%. You know, is that the cure for Alzheimer's? Is it a way to, you know, deliver cancer chemotherapy with less side effects? There can be some really important stuff that gets cut. So it's not a fear that things are going to come to a screeching halt. It's just a fear that Boston and Massachusetts, which really attract a huge amount, you know, we are the leading recipient of this funding from the National Institutes of Health. It's that we slow down, you know, that we're less productive, and also that we attract fewer of these really talented star researchers to our state who may stay in academia, may stay at hospitals doing research, but they also may form companies that are going to create lots of jobs here.
Mm. So what's the impact? I mean, how does the impact on a city like Boston compare with other cities? I mean, you mentioned that we're a hub for this kind of stuff, so presumably that we'd probably feel the cuts more here. Is that right?
I think we are a hub for research, and so people have been talking for the last few weeks and really for the last year about what the NIH impact is going to be in Boston, you know, because there's so much research that is. I feel like, you know, the whole nature of this, of sequestration, is these very brute force across the board cuts. So everyone is griping about how they're going to be impacted, by it. And I think also in Boston, you know, our nature is, hey, let's do this, you know, let's take the intellectual scientific approach and actually create a list of priorities and maybe say that, gee, medicine and science and, you know, understanding disease and curing disease is kind of an important thing for our country. And so why would we cut that the same way we're cutting everything else? But, you know, unfortunately, the way these cuts work is they are very insensitive, should we say.
Mm. Finally, what I mean, let's sort of hypothetically, if research funding is cut and a lab is shut down, for example, or slowed down or shuttered for a while, can these labs just be restarted if more money comes in, or is there an opportunity lost for good?
I think the concern, I would be surprised if there are labs that are going to shut entirely with NIH cutting 8 or 10% of its funding. I think the concern is just that, you know, part of the concern is, are there going to be other countries that are continuously investing in research, and that you just don't want to have this start and stop approach. I mean, you see the same thing in clean energy funding, you know, where you have credits for, say, wind production that start up and stop and start up and stop. And so you have this very, you know, very unpredictable environment. And I think that, you know, science is something that doesn't take a year or 2 years or even 3 years to make progress, that you need long-term investment, you know, to really understand how human biology works and how new drugs can be developed to affect diseases. And so, you know, the researchers will go elsewhere. They'll take their smarts elsewhere and presumably be working in labs. Some of them will be working in labs in other countries where there's just kind of more consistent support for science.
Hmm. Scott Kirzner is the Boston Globe's innovation reporter. Scott, as always, thanks so much. Good to have you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's turn toward the politics of this situation. Linda Bilmes served as Assistant Secretary of Commerce during the Clinton administration. Now she's the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Senior Lecturer in Public Policy at Harvard. And Linda Bilmes, welcome back to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Thank you.
We talked to you in the past about how all of this is self-inflicted and in many ways unnecessary. When I say self-inflicted, inflicted by Congress on the U.S. Are you seeing anything this week in these final days that would make you think that there's a way out of this sequestration thicket?
Well, I think the problem is not just the sequestration this week, which is this particular budget impasse, but the problem is, why are we in this continual budget fiasco? Mm. And there are a couple of reasons. One is political and the other is structural. On the political side, the problem is that many Republicans are defining the problem based on a completely flawed assumption, which is that our national budget crisis arises purely from too much spending. But the debt is not just about spending. It's the relationship between tax revenues coming in and spending going out, and the interest paid on what we borrowed in the past. So when we look at our national debt, which is a problem. I mean, that debt has grown primarily because of a very steep reduction in tax revenues, which occurred because of the recession and because of the tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, combined with spending on Iraq and Afghanistan and the Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit and so forth. So, you know, this is one sort of political issue about how you define the problem. And then there's a structural reason, which is that the basic process for budgeting is not working anymore.
Mm. So what are some of the steps? I mean, let's stick with that structural piece. What are some of the steps that Congress could take to avoid governing sort of crisis to crisis like we've been doing for the past period of time now?
Well, it's important to note that many states and local governments, which do a pretty good job of budgeting, as well as a number of countries, have fixed this kind of problem. So it's not rocket science. I've proposed a few simple steps, including creating an annual budget less often, because we don't need to revisit the air traffic control budget all the time, every few months. You know, secondly, to change the framework that we use for budgeting and accounting so we can actually see where money is spent. Third, to eliminate the budgeting tricks such as being able to use emergency money to appropriate for the wars and other everyday predictable expenses, and fourth, to overhaul the congressional budget process, which right now does not allow Congress to see the mandatory entitlement spending in the same place or in the same way that it looks at the annual discretionary spending. So it's a very flawed system, and it hasn't been overhauled in about 40 years.
Well, those sets of that sort of set of prescriptions, it's an ambitious one. Do you think there's the political will now in Washington to sort of tackle this? Because I'm not seeing evidence of that, if there is.
Well, I would say that at the new members of Congress training session, which we teach here at the Kennedy School, when I was discussing these issues with a number of the newly elected members, they were very interested in structural reform. And I think that they are hearing the exasperation in the public. So that's on the plus side. On the negative side, the leadership in Congress has not embraced, I think, the need for structural reforms because they are on a constant two-year electoral cycle. And a lot of these reforms are things that would produce significant gains over 4 or 5 years, but they are not the kind of thing you can take home to the electorate and say, wow, you know, we're going to do accounting reforms.
Yeah. One question, final question, Linda Bilmes. Is there any silver lining to this? In other words, if this whole sequestration process was to force lawmakers to come to terms with spending, I think most people agree that this isn't probably the best way to come to terms with it, but it has put it on the agenda. People sort of understand, if they didn't before, that we are spending more than we're taking in a big, big way. So in some way, is this getting that message across in a way that might be constructive?
I don't think so, unfortunately. I think that it's absolutely the opposite. I think people realize that there is a lot of waste and inefficiency in government, but people also know that this kind of cuts, cutting the NIH budget, cutting the air traffic control budget, is not the way to get at the waste in government. It doesn't make things better. In fact, it makes things worse. And I think that what happens is that you have more frustration among the federal workforce, you have more frustration among the electorate, and you have a lot of disruption, which is unnecessary in the working of government.
Well, Linda Bilmes, thank you so much for joining us again today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Linda Bilmes. She's a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a former assistant secretary of commerce in the Clinton administration. And you can find a report on what cuts are coming for Massachusetts at our website, radioboston.org. Now, some quick feedback from you on our program. There's a conversation ongoing right now at RadioBoston.org about our talk last week with U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz and allegations that she overreached in the case against internet activist Aaron Swartz and several other cases handled by her office. Swartz took his own life last month while facing 13 felony charges for downloading scholarly articles from an academic database at MIT. Jeff writes on our website, "Having myself faced the possibility of 20 years in prison for over 2 years before my charges were ultimately dropped with no fanfare, I can almost understand why someone like Aaron Swartz might take his own life." Another listener commented, "Those who are traumatized, stigmatized, or victimized by such shenanigans within the legal system may suffer from what has come to be called legal abuse syndrome, which could well be the subject of a future story on Radio Boston." Well, the conversation continues. We love hearing from you. You can share your thoughts and ideas with us at radioboston.org and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And stay with us. Coming up, MBTA Chief Beverly Scott offers her vision for the state's ailing public transportation system, and she takes your questions. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.